KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Because of the terrible poverty there, policymakers in the U.S. have felt for years that, oh, any kind of development is good development, including sweatshop development.
We are here to advocate that the decision as to whether or not a particular woman will continue to carry or will terminate a pregnancy is a decision that should be made by that individual. That in fact she has a constitutional right to make that decision for herself.
That's Sarah Wedding, and speaking to the Supreme Court 40 years ago, arguing Roe versus Wade. We're going to talk to her in a little bit. You also heard Amy Wallance talking about development in Haiti. Let me get her assessment of what's happening there, personal and political. But we start with West Sound Bank, taken over by the FDIC in 2009, a loss of $100 million. Details are emerging on how the Bremerton Community Bank was looted, how regulators missed opportunities to stop the bank's misdeeds much earlier. Richard Hager, real estate agent and appraiser, fraud profiler, joins us. It's been a long time.
Morning.
It's good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
We have to have you and Linda back to take some calls from folks about
foreclosures. You bet.
Foreclosures, because I guess it's still happening.
Still happening.
People are still trying to buy homes and stay in their homes.
Absolutely.
It's not like this crisis has ended. Has abated.
It's slowed down a bit here in the Seattle area, but outlying areas beyond King County, it still hurts a bit. And if you get closer to Phoenix or Central Florida, it's a lot. So the crisis, if you will, is still out there, but our real estate here in Seattle is hot and moving up, and it's helping to relieve that problem.
All right. What happened with West Sound Bank? What made it such a fraudulent place?
Well, number one, the people that are at the top that were running it, inept, bottom line. They were put themselves together as we can run a business, aren't we wonderful? And they may understand checking and savings, but they definitely did not understand the mortgage industry and how that functioned. So lots and lots of missteps and just poor mismanagement from the top down.
Criminal?
I would say so.
You were looking at some of the appraisals. When did you start looking at West Sound Bank? How did you get called in?
Well, the original was I do classes on real estate and mortgage fraud. In fact, I'll be doing up at North Seattle Community College in March. And I do classes for license renewal for agents, appraisers, attorneys, law enforcement. And I was over in Silverdale in about 2006, I think it was, 6 or 7. And I do a class, and as I describe a fraud, the buyer is getting $100,000 cash back. This group in the corner all of a sudden would stop. They'd turn to each other and they'd start to kibitz, and then they'd come back and focus on the class again. And this happened about three times as I'd go through the various frauds. And then they started to become very challenging of, when did that become illegal? And you don't know what you're talking about. You're just an appraiser. Like, dude, don't you know who I am? And then at one of the breaks, it was kind of humorous. And at one of the breaks.
And that you were somebody who actually did know the laws.
I actually did. Isn't that fun? And at one of the breaks, another participant comes over, and she's sitting there going, are you wondering about that group in the corner? It's like, yeah, what's up with that? She goes, well, they're from West Sound Bank and another mortgage brokerage firm that they work very tight with. They're doing what you're describing. And that's why they're afraid. And so they're challenging you, trying to come back. It's like, I got it. So the rest of the class was very challenging, but I carry indictments with me, the laws, and I hand them out to these people. So they were made aware of this. And so that was the first time we had bumped into that. I think it was about a year later, something like that. I'm down at the DFI, Department of Financial Institutions, and I'm chatting with them, and I go, I had this encounter. And I start to describe it. And the DFI kind of went, really? Give me the names of those people. What was going on? There was this heightened interest in there. And so literally since about, I think it was 6 or 7, I've had these bump-ins with people from West Sound, right down to the point where they've ordered appraisals from my firm. We didn't come in at the value they wanted. And they would call up and yell at me, going, you're $100,000 under. You're a bad appraiser. And I go, well, you're doing a kickback under the table.
Now, how did you know that?
We had copies of the purchase and sale agreement, and it was showing $100,000 to the buyer in the way of closing costs and repairs and things like that. But the house didn't need repair.
That sounds illegal.
It does to me, too.
So when did regulators start to close in on this bank?
I would assume about the same time. I don't know. You know, it's kind of a while I can talk to them. We do classes together and we're friendly. But if they're investigating somebody, they're not going to tell me about that just because of confidentiality.
Now, the Seattle Times had an investigation on this. You were quoted in that investigation. Mm-hmm. One of the things they pointed out, a couple of people who have since left the country. Mm-hmm. Who is Louis Weir?
Well, you've got a lot of people that were in management at the top. And not only were they kind of unaware of what they were doing, but in addition, in the first part of the series from Sanjay on Sunday, they were giving
Sunday
themselves
the Times reporter.
The Times reporter, correct?
Yeah,
they were giving themselves personal loans. You know, they would the president of the bank would give himself a nice loan for $1 million here and $1 million there at really favorable rates. And there's a limit on how much you can do those, how big the loan amount is and the discount, because it's seen as favoritism. And so these people were getting this kickback, if you will, or favorable terms on loans. And they would then go and get involved with buying real estate or investment and developments. And they'd form all sorts of partnerships. And that's where you've got literally a web of people that are pulled together. And going to the Seattle Times on their Sunday and looking this up, the reporter's done an excellent job of kind of showing where those loans are.
Well, some of those folks seem to be either engaged in criminal activity or connected to people in a criminal activity.
Yes.
And then some of them fled to other countries.
Yes.
What kind of punishment has been meted out on the people who looted this bank? And it's fair to say they looted this bank.
In my opinion, I would agree with you. The people at the top, there were investigations. The FDIC filed civil charges against them demanding, I think, $100 million. And then they ended up negotiating it down to like $1.7 million. That seems a little small to me, considering the size of this.
Does that tell you anything, the fact that they did do that?
I'm disappointed in those results. How's that? I wasn't there for the negotiation. I don't know all of the details, so I can't really go down the path. But I will tell you, $1.7 million payoff and then an insurance company paying for that seems to be pennies on the dollar from what they did.
Richard Hager is a real estate agent and appraiser. He holds fraud classes. He's a fraud profiler. He works with various agencies. He was one of the people looking at West Sound, hired by government agencies, and later talked to by the Seattle Times reporter who's been working on the West Sound bank mm-hmm. collapse. Where were the regulators?
I don't think they were there the way they should be. Should the feds were there. They went in, they did some audits, and they said, bad boys, don't do it again. Here's our recommendations for doing it better. And then the bank kind of went, yeah, okay. And they appear to have just continued down the same path. So at that point, the feds, whether it's the FDIC or the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, they should have jumped on those guys hard and fast, and it appears to be a failure of that. Why? Federal government isn't good at regulating a lot of banks.
Well, and what about the state? The state regulators were looking at having concerns about it for much
yes.
of the aughts.
Yes, yes. Your Department of Financial Institutions. I'm assuming, well, they were aware of it. They were looking at this. It does take some time to investigate. Why they didn't do more faster, I think that's a great question for them down there to see what's going on. I've helped train some of the people that are there. They're very good at what they do. Why there wasn't more action, I have not a clue. Couldn't even go down there.
So here's how Sanjay Bhatt was writing about this in the Times. He said, this is West Sound's legacy in King and Pierce counties. From 2005 to 2007, a rogue loan officer at the bank's mm-hmm. Federal Way branch made at least 120 home construction loans totaling $118 million to amateur Russian and Ukrainian builders.
Yes.
Amateur, i.e., they weren't really builders at all.
No, they weren't. In one instance, the guy had been a plumber for about a week and a half, and all of a sudden he's being shown to be this wonderfully experienced builder. Teresa Feller, I think, was the loan officer down in Fed Way. And she figured out how to manipulate the system from the reports that have come out on this one. She would get these people approved for construction loans. No other bank would do it. And all of a sudden, they're building homes, and the homes are terrible. I mean, we've appraised some of those, and they don't fit in the Pacific Northwest at all. And then they wouldn't sell, or they would borrow $1.5 million on a house to build it and only put $500,000 into building it. somebody was siphoning off a lot of money, and it was usually these builders that were doing that.
Yeah. Some of these Russians have gone, or Eastern Europeans have gone back to their countries, the Kravchenkos.
Yep, and there were indictments against them. You know, we have federal indictments against them.
Feller is banned from working in a federally insured bank.
Boo-hoo.
Maslov, another one, he couldn't be reached to comment, but he sold a house that he had bought for $1.1 million using all that money.
Yes.
And then he had to sell it for $400,000.
Short sale, Bellevue.
Hurt the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, people go, well, it's the banks robbing us, or it's, you know, we blame it on a lot of other people, and, oh, what's the big impact? Well, the impact is where you had a house that may have been worth $1.5 million is now selling for $500,000. Everybody in that neighborhood is damaged by this. Property taxes are going to decline. Property values are going to decline. And so we all have a stake in how these banks are operated.
Of course, it wasn't worth $1.5 million.
Never was.
But it was, that was the fraud.
Yes. Yes, and bad appraisals supporting it.
Is this still going on?
Yes.
Well, that's depressing.
No, it's not at West Sound. I mean, they're gone.
They're gone. Other right. banks are still engaged in these kind of practices?
Yes.
How you know this?
Well, we'll get appraisal orders in, and part of an appraiser's job is to analyze the real estate transaction, analyze the property, and determine what a market value is. So it's kind of a three-part. And we'll go in and look at some of these properties, and they're clearly overpriced. Selling appears to be selling for too much. We'll go in and appraise them, and we'll find that the values, maybe they're puffed by 30%. Then we get angry phone calls from the agents or the loan officers that are there, and later we find out that there was other money being passed around to pay for closing costs or down payments, or in several instances, a brand new car would be included. We've got a condominium over in Alki right now that the agent is offering a brand new car if you purchase their condo.
Is that legal?
Illegal. And that in some of these things would go through the bank. We would get the appraisal orders. I go look at the ads for the property, and it's like going, get my brand new car. And it's like, well, it's not going to be worth that. If we take the car out of the deal, the house is not worth that sales price. And so we do see this on a fairly regular basis even today.
All right. Two last questions. One, how do I as a consumer, or how do other consumers protect themselves from this kind of fraud?
Well, one is to find good local banks, solid ones that have been around. Without a doubt, credit unions and banks, they're out there. There's good local. I prefer local. You know, regional to local is better.
Well, West Sound was local.
It was. And, you know, it hurts that certain segment of that. But I'll tell you, I see more problems with the big banks than the small. A lot of these small banks are well run. And so I'm a fan of them, if you will.
The big banks are still a part of this problem?
Yes.
The big named banks?
Absolutely.
The too big to fail banks?
Yes.
Where are the regulators? Why can't regulators force illegal activity?
I think that's a darn good question to be asked at time and time.
Well, are there fewer regulators involved? Is that what's going on?
Well, you're seeing a coalescence of the regulators down to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, big, big 100-pound gorilla out there. And they're doing a pretty good job on this. So they're new, and they're coming on, and they're starting to kick tush. So that's a good thing. But the big banks, they all own their own appraisal firms. And there's subtle pressure that comes to us. If we don't make value, if we don't do something, I get nasty phone calls or never hired again.
I guess we're just going to see this fraud and problem continue. I don't know what solves the problem.
Well,
there's too much money involved.
Clarity, you know, having good auditors that are there properly trained, which is a problem for the FDIC. They used to have 20,000 auditors. I think they went down to a low of 5,000 auditors nationwide. They're staffing up. Having them properly trained so they can spot this stupid stuff inside of banks is good. And having properly trained appraisers who do their job could, in fact, good appraisals would have probably stopped half of the bad deals at West Sound, if only they could have had good appraisals.
Well, good, i.e. honest.
True.
All right.
Absolutely.
Richard Hagert is a real estate agent and appraiser. He's a fraud profiler. He's teaching a class about real estate and mortgage fraud, foreclosure rescue, and short sale fraud at North Seattle Community College. We have links at our Facebook page, and that's Weekday on KUOW. Find him as well. West Sound Bank was taken over by the FDIC in 2009, a loss of $100 million. If you want to read what Richard's talking about, you can also go to the Seattle Times. Sanjay Bhatt has written a few stories about West Sound and its failure.
Just a few.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's 9:19. In a minute here, a conversation about abortion rights and restrictions. Our guest is Sarah Weddington. She's the lawyer who argued Roe v. Wade before the Supreme Court. That's just a minute away. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hedvig and the Angry Inch, a co-production with Balogun Theater, starring Jarek Hoffer, live at the Moore Theater, now through January 27th. Tickets available at stgpresents.org.
44 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says we're going to get some rain today. That rain is going to taper off to showers by this afternoon. It's probably not going to get any warmer than it is right now, 44. Overnight, clouds, chance of showers, and a low of 35. Tomorrow, Thursday, clouds, chance of rain, mainly in the afternoon, and a high of 46. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:20. A bit later this hour, we're going to talk about the continuing struggle to rebuild Haiti after its destructive 2010 earthquake. That's just about 20 minutes away.
Roe v. Wade became the law of the land 40 years ago. The battles over abortion continue. 2011, 2012 saw new restrictions on abortion access in many states. Washington State had a big rally over abortion, anti-abortion rally, just yesterday. And in that rally, State Senator announced that he was introducing a bill to restrict some access to abortion. Where we are today and what that means for the future, we take up with Sarah Weddington, who was 26 years old when she went before the Supreme Court to argue Roe v. Wade. What do you think about that? If I'm throwing that out there.
It's good. That means 40 years, you know how old I am.
She served three terms in the Texas State Legislature after that. She was assistant to the president in the Carter administration, taught at the law school at the University of Texas in 2012. She also runs the Weddington Foundation.
Center.
The Weddington Center, which I did not put in there. I apologize. To do education work around the country on these issues. Grab that mic. Pull it towards you.
Here we go.
No, pull it towards you. Make yourself comfortable. Say your name.
I'm Kristen Glimberg-Prosser.
Three. Sometimes when things, you got it? Head of Planned Parenthood.
No, actually just the media relations.
Media relations. Okay.
A key person in Planned Parenthood. And we had a full crowd last night. Packed.
And were there opponents there too?
No.
Not
waving
a one.
Signs?
No. I guess they were all tired from the noon rally.
Why is there so much at the state legislative level seeking restrictions on abortion?
It's a national strategy. Those who are opposed to abortion have decided they're not going to be able to overturn Roe versus Wade anytime soon. Because with Obama having been elected and the current Supreme Court being a 5-4 in favor of Roe versus Wade, then the chances of someone who's anti-Roe being appointed in the next 4 years is not good. So instead, they're going to focus on the state legislatures and go against access. So what they're trying to do is pass legislation where even if abortion is legal, it will be unavailable or so expensive for women who need services that they will not be able to get services.
42 states and the District of Columbia have enacted a number of measures over these past couple of years. Explain what some of those measures have done.
There's a combination. One of them is a piece of legislation that would say, for a woman who's a minor, she must have parental involvement. That's what was introduced here yesterday. And why it's important that I think your listeners know that Washington, while it is a great state, one of the best in terms of how they treat women and the availability of abortion, it's going to be harder here, and we're going to have help to be sure that is defeated. Another kind of legislation would say that after a woman comes to a clinic, she must wait 24 hours, or in other states, 72 hours, before she can actually have a procedure. Now, the people introducing, and there are others, but the people introducing these are really people who are totally against abortion. But they wrap it in this language about we're only doing this for the benefit of women so they can have time to think about it, as if they hadn't been thinking about it for days. Or you get measures that say the woman must have a sonogram. Well, most women, 90%, have abortions when they're in very early pregnancy. So you cannot do jelly on the belly at that point, which when you say sonogram, that's what people think of. And instead, you have to use a vaginal
probe. Transvaginal ultrasound, right?
That's right. So it's about this long. And one of the young women legislators in Texas last year, who's Hispanic from Houston, brought one of those and said, now, if any of you men would like to really understand what you're going to require of women, I'd be happy to show this to you more intimately. It still passed. Go ahead.
Well, what's Mike Padden's bill in the state Senate?
It's a bill that would require parental notification.
Of under 18?
For under 18.
Yeah. Now, what's the rule now for parental notification
There's
in the state?
No parental notification in Washington State.
At all?
At all.
Required?
Required.
Now, often women do talk to their parents if they have a good relationship. But see, that bill doesn't look at the fact that sometimes you have situations of sexual abuse by people in the home. Sometimes you have situations where the parents, it could be that one of the parents is remarried and the step-parent has a different fee. You have all kinds of problems in that.
You just can't know what the situation is in a home, and you can't. If there's one child, if there's one young woman who's vulnerable, you need to protect.
You know, we don't need to argue about abortion rights too much since you are both in support of it. But I want to know what happened. Here was the Pew study, right? Mm-hmm. A quarter of U.S. public sees abortion as morally wrong, but 42% do not see it as morally wrong. One in five see it as morally wrong but don't want it overturned. That was a Pew study. But the other thing they found was that young people under 30 don't know what Roe is. Don't understand what their rights are. And that has to fall on you guys.
It does. And I was on an airplane not long ago, and I had on a button. It had a coat hanger in the middle and a slash across it. And that
thought you were a dry cleaner?
Well, the flight attendant finally stopped and said, what do you have against coat hangers? And for us, that meant no more coat hanger abortion, no more back alley abortion. And that was the moment I realized we had more explanation to do. We had to, and that was what we did last night at Town Hall, packed crowd. And a former woman who was head of Planned Parenthood here told some of the stories about people who'd come to Planned Parenthood and the reasons they wanted an abortion. Or one case, the reason they decided not to have an abortion, but why they felt so strongly it was their decision, not the legislators.
Why has that notion failed to become their decision, a woman's decision, failed to become cemented in this country over 40 years?
Well, I think it's two things.
Sarah Weddington, who argued the case in the 70s for the Supreme Court.
I think it's two things. One is that we haven't spent enough time trying to educate about why it is so important. Now, when we started doing Roe, we were also, that was when women couldn't get credit without a man's signature, their husband, their father. It was when women were still running half-court basketball, and after two dribbles, it was called traveling, a technical violation. That was when if a woman reported a rape, more often she was put on trial of her prior sexual conduct. And so it was when women who were public school teachers were forced to quit if they got pregnant. And so it was this wide range of things. The University of Texas in Austin had a policy that no woman could have access to contraception, no student, unless she certified she was within 6 weeks of marriage, because you needed to start the pill to be protected for your wedding night, but certainly you wouldn't need it otherwise. And so there were a lot of unprotected pregnancies. And so people started saying, I can't finish this. I don't have the money or the time for a child right now. I'd like children, but not right now. Where can I go for an abortion? And it was a group of young graduate students that started trying to answer that. And so their question to me was, can we give women this information, or would we be guilty of being a person who's helping commit a crime, an accomplice? And I said, I don't know. I'll go to the library and look it up. And eventually they said to me, we need to file a lawsuit. Would you mind doing that? And at first I was really taken back. I had never done a contested case. I couldn't get a job with a law firm. They said women have to be home to cook dinner and lawyers have to work late.
This is the 60s?
Oh, yeah. This is 69. Eventually I said, you know, I had done uncontested divorces, wills for people with no money, and one adoption for my uncle. And I said, you know, I haven't really had a lot of experience. And they said, yes, but you're the only woman lawyer we know. And we think it's important for a woman to represent women in this case. And second, you're willing to do it for free. And you're the only one we know. And so, yeah, I did it for free.
You know, I was reading the Vanity Fair profile of Roe.
Mm-hmm.
Not the best client for you to take this case to if you wanted to have somebody who was photogenic, who was going to be appealing to the justices. And yet you took her. Because,
why?
Yeah.
Well, it was two
things. And she was also late by the time you got to it, she was too late in the pregnancy. She wasn't going to be getting an abortion anyway.
Yeah, and that's what we told her. You know, you're too far along. But by you helping us with this case, because we needed a pregnant plaintiff. And the thing is, when you do a case, you need someone who has a genuine case or controversy. And she was very pregnant. So we said, you're not going to be able to get an abortion, but you could help other women not to have to go through what you have. And the other was, she'd already had a child that her mother had taken away from her on the basis she was unfit to raise a child. And so that, to us, also from a judge's point of view, would explain why not every woman is a perfect mother and why you should not force every woman to go through every pregnancy. So we were trying to look at it from the judge's point of view instead of looking at, you know, is she a good PR representative?
So she's, do you ever talk to her?
Not since she changed sides.
She's changed sides. Born again.
Yeah, she was 25 years pro-choice. And I thought the most interesting comment in that article was, Jane Roe is not pro-choice. She is not anti-choice. She is pro-herself and will do whatever is necessary for what she sees as her own financial best interest.
But I'm sure you have had many discussions with people who take the moral argument about abortion.
Yes, but the one that I hear most now is, how could you represent a case based on a lie? Well, it wasn't based on a lie.
Oh, the original Roe v. Wade case.
Yes, because Jane Roe, after the case, we didn't say anything in the case about how she got pregnant. The Texas law was no abortion is legal except to save the life of the woman. Rape had nothing to do with whether it was legal or illegal. After the case was decided, she gave an interview and she said, I was working in a seedy carnival in a seedy part of rural Georgia in 1969, and three men, a black, a white, and possibly a Hispanic, brutally raped me. And I read that and I thought, I don't think 1969 rural Georgia, that doesn't fit. Well, she sold her story for a movie, and it was going to start with a brutal rape scene. But before they made the movie, she did an interview with Carl Rowan, a very distinguished black commentator and TV interviewer. And he said to her, what about the rape? And she said, I lied. So I didn't lie. She lied, but it was after the case was decided.
But I want to take you beyond that to the arguments that people are making about the moral choice of abortion when life begins. I want to leave all that aside, but just that moral question. When people say to you, abortion terminates a life, you should not be involved in that. What's your response to those folks?
Well, I think what they are totally doing is ignoring the woman. She is opaque to them. They don't see her at all. They don't see her story. They don't see her problems. They don't see her hopes. They don't see her other children. One of the things that...
They are doing that. Don't you agree? I mean, you were saying that, and that is what they're doing. But they're looking at the child or the fetus.
Yeah, they're totally ignoring the woman or the children she already has. That Pew poll said that most women who have an abortion already have one or usually two children.
Well, they're making them holy. They're making the fetus a life holy, something that cannot be challenged.
That's right. To them, it can't be challenged. But the Constitution says all persons born or naturalized are citizens. You do not get a deduction for the year that you are pregnant. You get it for the year you have a birth. There are lots of ways in which we have never looked at a fetus, and you see their states.
I think you should argue that, well, that tax law. That would be very effective.
Yeah, I mean, there, you just start thinking about all the ways of how we treat a person, and it does not start at the joinder of egg and sperm. And several states, the opponents have introduced bills called personhood bills that say when the egg and sperm join, that is a person. Well, that's been submitted to the public in several states, and they have turned it down in every one of it because so many people are relying on in vitro fertilization to have children. And that involves joining an egg and a sperm and then freezing it.
You know, Sarah Weddington, when did, for you, this issue, because you have to answer that question, you have to have this debate time and again, you've put yourself in a place where you're going out and speaking about this, when did it become more than a court case?
Well, while I was in law school, I became pregnant by the man I was dating and planning to marry, and we went to Mexico. It was illegal. But I know what it feels like to be in a back alley, and I was luckier than most. I had the money in my savings account. The man in my life went with me. He was the one that found the place to go. It was a good doctor. I had no problems. But there are a lot of women who, most doctors in Texas at the time of Roe really were supportive of the case because they had worked as interns and residents in what were called the IOB wards, the infected obstetrics wards, of women who had done self-abortion or illegal abortion and were there because they were in emergency situations and the doctors were trying to save their fertility, trying to heal perforations, trying to save their lives. And the doctors said, you know, what we've really learned is when you make abortion illegal, what you have is illegal abortion. And that's what was happening. And I don't want women to go through that.
What's the response at the state level from the Weddington Center, from Planned Parenthood, since you have seen these very powerful forces moving to make changes at the state level? What do you see? And then I want to ask about what's Washington's response. But what's the response at the state level? Are you guys galvanized? Do you feel you're galvanized to fight?
No, I think we're starting. We are starting more independent political action funds so that we have money to give to those people who are in our favor. We are the guy who introduced the sonogram bill in Texas got beat this last fall, and I was so happy about that. You know, you look at Portland, Oregon, you look at Washington, there are a lot of elected officials here who are really great. But I would trade you our governor for some of yours. He's terrible, and he's terrible on this issue. And the majority of our legislators are not good now. You know, what's interesting is it used to be the Republican Party. Many Republicans were pro-choice. Goldwater was pro-choice. His first wife has a clinic, Planned Parenthood Clinic, in Phoenix, named for her. You know, the Fords, they were both pro-choice. There were a lot of Republicans that were pro-choice. But now, if a person is a Republican and they want to run for something, they're afraid to even admit that they might have been pro-contraception. I can't believe it.
So Mike Patton's bill is going to get a hearing for the first time. Senate Republicans are in charge of the Senate, state Senate. What's your response?
Well, it's the first time that it's come up since 1998. And
did it get a hearing back then?
It did.
Oh.
Yeah. And we've been lucky that we haven't had to deal with this issue since. Washington State is progressive with regard to abortion rights.
Eastern Washington, too?
Not specifically, not by legislative district, but, you know, we have the majority here in the state. And I think that, you know, Planned Parenthood knows that with regard to parental notification that, you know, most of the teens already talk to their parents about this. And there are a few that just can't. And those are the ones that we have to protect, and we have to fiercely protect them. And so that's why we're here. We will fight this bill. We will also advocate for the Reproductive Parity Act that's up. And what that says is that, you know, when health insurance reform comes into play, that we will make sure that if health insurance policies included within that cover maternity care, they are going to have to cover abortion care.
Now, we hear Republican leaders saying that in the Senate that they're going to support that. Reproductive Parity Act.
Do you see
that happening?
In Washington State, it's been incredibly civil. It's been incredibly bipartisan. That's the history of our reproductive health policy here in the state. The national mood has not been that way. But we see it. We saw it with the elections. You know, every time an anti-choice politician opens their mouth and says something demeaning toward women, they don't win. And that's where the American people are.
So Planned Parenthood is going to testify when Mike Patton's bill comes up?
We'll be there.
Christine Glenberg is a communications director, agent, director.
Yes.
Communications director for Planned Parenthood, Washington. Sarah Whitington, as a former state legislator, assistant to the president in the Carter administration, taught at the University of Texas, runs the Whitington Center, and argued Roe v. Wade for the Supreme Court. Maybe get a little history for some of those young people. They need a little history, right?
We're working on it. That's part of why I'm traveling.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is Weekday.
It's 9:40. A look at the ongoing struggle to rebuild Haiti after the big 2010 earthquake in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Hi, this is Jack Spear with NPR News. You've heard us say it many times, and it's still true. You are the public in public radio. Everything you hear on KUOW is only possible with your support. So if it's been a while since you've made a gift to KUOW, please renew your support today. It's easy. Go online to KUOW.org. And thank you.
You need to make a tough decision, like moving or quitting your job. You weigh the pros and cons, you think it over, but still, you're stuck.
If all else fails, we are going to provide you an enormous service, which is we are going to flip a coin for you. It's a new breed of economics.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tough decisions made easy, as only Freakonomics can. That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Heads, that airs tonight at 6:30. Tails, that airs tonight at 6:30. KUOW 94.9.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
44 degrees in Seattle. Probably not going to get any warmer than that today. It's cloudy now. Forecast says we're going to get some rain, and that's going to turn to showers later on. It's 9:41. A Canadian jihadist stands accused by the Algerian government of having played a major role in the Algeria hostage taking. More on that in 25 minutes.
Author and journalist Amy Willens first visited Haiti in 1985. Since then, through her coverage of major events, political changes, she has come to feel that nation is essential to her. Her latest book, well, actually, I want to say, she's written, how many books have you written about Haiti?
This is my second.
So the rainy season, Haiti since Duvalier. I feel earthquakes more often than they happen, coming to California in the age of Schwarzenegger, which I do like. And her latest book is Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you, Steve.
Who's Fred Voodoo?
Well, Fred Voodoo is the old name that journalists used to use for the Haitian man in the street, kind of like Joe Sixpack. It was a less politically correct time when I first got to Haiti. And it's also in the book, I talk about Fred Voodoo as this kind of receptacle where the white man, the outsider in Haiti, puts all of his prejudices and stereotypes of the Haitian in order to be able to objectify and not really have to think about this person.
Do you have examples of things you've seen?
Well,
you
know,
in your book.
Yeah, just to call the person Fred Voodoo, first of all, you know, people from...
Well, who used that? Who used that phrase?
It was a British journalist. But people from the outside think of Haitians as completely other, completely different from themselves, from first worlders, from Westerners. They think that this is an old African country, and it's not. It's a very complicated place. But until you open yourself up to what Haiti really is and provides, you won't know how to deal with Haiti.
What do you mean by that? What Haiti is and what it provides?
Well, I mean all the complicated things that have fed into creating this very complicated nation. First of all, a lot of outsiders don't realize Haiti is very French. A lot of the corruption you see in government is old-fashioned French. A lot of the intense concentration on politics very French, so that in the political class, I mean, we don't even say in America the political class, but in Haiti and in France they say la classe politique. They're only thinking about politics and how to get ahead so that policy and issues don't get addressed.
So is this because, I mean, the revolution was 1790.
1791, that's right.
1791. Is this because they speak the language? They're still so connected?
Well, no, but they follow, you know, from the revolution, what they did was free themselves from France, but they didn't free themselves from a French mentality. These were all people who grew up on French plantations, the people who did the revolution. But the revolution itself is a big problem for Haiti because, though it's a magnificent human achievement, not a lovely thing to live through, of course, but it was an incredible thing for slaves to throw off the greatest imperium in the world at the time and the biggest army. But it came too early, and the world was not ready for freed slaves. The white world was not ready for them.
Why are you saying goodbye?
I'm not saying goodbye. I'm saying goodbye to the stereotype of Fred Voodoo. I'm saying long may Haiti reign. Yeah. No, I hope. I hope. Well, with the book, I hope to dispel a lot of those stereotypes.
Do you see that happening, though? In the book and in what's happening, do you see the stereotypes falling away?
No. In fact, I see the post-earthquake world in Haiti as almost a rubber stamping of the stereotype, because so many people have come down from the outside who really haven't had the time, and many of them not the inclination, to learn about Haiti or really to understand what they themselves are doing in Haiti.
Amy Willens is a journalist and an author. She teaches literary journalism at University of California, Irvine. This is an example, yes? This book? Literary journalism.
I think so. Someone has said so, but I thought maybe they said so only because they saw that I teach it at Irvine.
Well, Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. So here's what you write a little bit into the book. Well, quite a bit into the book. Here's how the narrative goes. Haitians are desperate. We come down to help. They are nice people, maybe, but they're disorganized, uneducated, untrained, corrupt. We give, they steal. We are upright, they lie to us. Despite all our best intentions for them, our work here is thwarted and eventually ineffective. We get nothing accomplished. And end of there concludes the narrative. A narrative of the developed world to the starving world.
Well, that's how we have to think in Haiti, because over the years we've been ostensibly, and say, let's take USAID, the development branch of the United States government. So USAID has been working in Haiti for maybe 70 years, maybe a little less. But really, Haiti has not advanced. I would say hunger is more pervasive in Haiti than it was when USAID first came in. I would say there's still a severe lack of educational facilities in Haiti. The state in Haiti still doesn't work for Haitians. And it is not Haitian intransigence that's done that, but simply poor development strategies that don't take into account the culture of the country, that don't people who don't speak the language of the country. And then what happens is you give and you give and you give, and none of your programs works, and then you blame it on the Haitians rather than taking a look at your own programs. And that's why this stereotype comes to be. It's a very self-satisfying stereotype, because if I, say, dump a load of money on you, Steve, and tell
Please.
you should, you know, get your life together, and you don't, and then I say, okay, well, Steve's a jerk, and I gave him what he should have been able to work with, and I'm going to give it to another person now. It didn't work. Let's do it again. That's how it works.
You've talked about the Haitian way, that you wished more of the approaches would incorporate the Haitian way. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I hope I'm not falling into stereotypes here on my own, but there is, in the countryside in Haiti, say, which is less polluted by the outside world than the capital, Port-au-Prince, in the countryside,
polluted,
corrupted, changed. There is a kind of community that works together to build things. If you're putting up a roof, people come together. It's called a combite from Africa, and they still work that way in the countryside. The whole little village will come together to put up, like the pioneers in America. There's a kind of I guess you would call it a safety net in the countryside that doesn't exist in the city. There are family ties that are very, very strong that go unrecognized and unacknowledged by outsiders. And of course, there's an incredible language that's spoken throughout the country that often these outsiders don't learn. So they don't really know what's going on at all.
Creole.
Creole. I can speak a little for you if you want.
I would.
M'taremen parler avec vous, Steve. So that means I'd like to talk to you, Steve.
So there was, I heard the French in there.
Yeah, yeah, parler.
But other parts of other speeches.
Yeah, actually, m'taremen is aimer, I would like. So it's all actually French there in that sentence, but it's changed by the African grammar.
You have met many people and have made many friends in Haiti over the years. Still have those friends, the ones that still live.
Most of them I still have, yeah.
Yeah, most of these.
The ones who aren't my enemies.
Like Aristide.
Well, he thinks he's my enemy. He thinks I'm his enemy, but I'm not.
What did you write about him that he thought was unfair?
Oh, I think, you know, I wasn't in Haiti, and I alleged some human rights abuses possibly by his people. In the pages of the LA Times, I believe that was where an opinion piece in the LA Times, and possibly I was wrong, possibly I wasn't, but I had been very supportive of him, and then I wasn't so supportive, and he didn't accept that, and he just turned his back.
This is a very personal book.
Yes.
This is you coming to terms with how you feel about Haiti and how the world treats Haiti.
And also about how we operate in Haiti, and when I say we, I don't exclude myself.
Mac McClelland. Who's Mac McClelland?
Mac McClelland is a journalist who was the human rights reporter for Mother Jones, and she came to Haiti, and she had an experience. She was riding in a taxi cab with a woman who had been a rape victim of a gang rape, a Haitian woman, in one of the refugee camps after the earthquake. And this woman saw one of her alleged abusers on the street from the safety of the taxi cab, but still was freaked out and started to scream. And Mac McClelland was reporting on this woman, and she started to tweet about this woman screaming, but she also got very upset herself. And she later came back to, I think, San Francisco and realized she had post-traumatic stress disorder from seeing this woman see her rapist and start screaming. So Mac McClelland took over the woman's traumatic stress, and then she had to, she wrote about this, I just find it hard to believe, but I'm very Victorian in certain ways. She had to go have fake rape with her boyfriend to get better from her post-traumatic stress, and she wrote about it on good.com.
No one should co-opt someone else's pain. My rule is don't be full of pity and charity. Don't feel sorry for them. Rule number one, be glad you're not in their situation, but don't pity. The pain is theirs. And in disasters and destroyed places, their pain and their survival are sometimes even important aspects of their identity. But don't pretend it's your story.
Right.
Do we do that? We, the developed world, to Haiti?
I think there's an aspect of charity and pity and that turns easily into condescension. And I write about a young man I've known for a long time, and he was one of Aristide's orphan boys. His name is Philibert. And Philibert, when he was a little guy, he would always come around and he would say, Amy, give me $5. I would not give him $5, but I gave him some money. But we were always friendly, and I learned a lot of my Creole from him. But I write toward the end of the book about the last time I saw him, which was on the first anniversary of the earthquake. He kind of just turned up in my face and seemed to be on drugs of some kind, and now he's like in his 30s. And it was very sad, and I watch him going away, and I think to myself in the book how Philibert and I have this long relationship, and I assume that he calls me mommy. Hey, mommy, give me $5. I assume that we have a relationship that has emotion in it. But then I'm thinking in the book, maybe it's just always been about our financial differences, and it's so easy for me, and even pleasant, to give him money. And I decide what to give him, and I decide how much to give him, and he just is a pit of need, and it's not fun for him, you know? And so I think that's the relationship that has to be cured.
You know, you ask yourself about post-traumatic stress and how you feel, and towards the end of the book, you write, oh, Mac McClelland, I understand it now, your need for violent sex. What did you understand about and some of this was tongue-in-cheek, I read.
Right.
But what do you come to understand about that exploitation?
Well, what I'm writing about there is how, okay, Mac has to go home and have a fake rape with her boyfriend Isaac to get over Haiti, to get over Haiti's pain. But I say there, I'm doing the same thing. I'm writing the book. That's how I get over the pain. I put this out there. You guys deal with it now. You read it. You can suffer or not suffer, but I'm getting rid of it. I'm getting rid of my stress by putting this out there in the middle of the night. You know, there. I think I was writing at 5
yeah,
in the morning.
Yeah, I believe you said that. Yeah. Did you? Get rid of your pain?
No. Never.
Never works, does it?
Sean Penn says, we need Haiti. And I love that quote because it's quite astute, as he is in general, about Haiti. And what he means is, you know, you come, first of all, you come to an appreciation of what you do have by seeing what they don't have. But that isn't enough, of course, for the Haitians. But it does, it puts kind of a fine point on our lives here in the first world, especially Seattle. My God, Seattle is the first world.
Yeah. I don't think that all outsiders here, at least the Americans, are in rehab, seeking redemption, some kind of laissez-faire for being safe and bourgeois in a world that also contains Haiti. I often think that all outsiders...
No,
yeah, you do think that. And you are with Sean. Sean Penn is somebody you do... At one point, I would have thought that he might have been somebody you wouldn't have respected, but you
right.
do respect what he
I
does.
I feared very much that he would be another big jerk or
he set himself
a big ego coming in to swashbuckle.
Yeah.
And there's an element of that because he's that kind of a persona, his character.
But he acknowledges that.
He knows what he is, yes. And he tries, he says, you know, as individuals, we always want to think that we're making something happen. But I think he is someone who has made some things happen.
What did he do differently?
He's Sean Penn. I think.
No, in terms of aid, in terms of
relationship. But I think the level of his fame in Haiti, which is so near us, really helped him in a way that it doesn't help someone who's a lesser actress or someone who just comes in and goes out. He came with all his fame to Haiti and stayed. He actually lived in the camp, I think, for Haitians. This was gigantically symbolic.
But did he
go
the Haitian way? Did he let Haitians determine the course of his...
He learned a lot from Haitians. At first, he followed advice from outsiders, and he made some real missteps, which I chronicle in the book. But then he started to figure it out. I still think he deals a lot with the bigger aid community, but he can make them do things that he wants to do, that he sees need to get done. For instance, the National Palace was a wreck. It's like having the White House lying in ruins but kind of visible, as if they never took down the World Trade Center after it was knocked down, as if they just left it standing there. For 3 years, the National Palace was sitting like that in the middle of Port-au-Prince. And Sean finally said, okay, come on, let's get this done. And he worked with Haitians and with the Haitian Preservation Society, and they went in and they took down the palace brick by brick. And if he hadn't gotten those people together to get it done, I'm not sure it would have gotten done. And it was a smart thing to do, and Haitians needed it to be done. They wanted it to be done, but no one was getting together to do it.
When you go back to Haiti, what will you do and what won't you do in terms of relating to your friends and also in the aid community?
Well, I'll try to find all my friends who are in trouble and try to help them. I am my own little aid community, which is kind of bad. There's this little boy whose hands were both chopped off during the earthquake. That's called traumatic amputation. He lost both his hands. And I found him after the earthquake, and then I lost track of him. I helped him out a little bit then. He's like 3 years old. And so last time I was down, I found him again, which I was really pleased to do. And all my Haitian friends said, you'll never find him. I need a photograph. I kept saying, you need a photograph of a boy with no hands? Just go to his town and say, I want the boy with no hands. You'll find him. And that's what I did. And I found him, and now I'm getting him prostheses. So that's my own little aid project. But, of course, I'm very worried that things will go badly for him for some reason that will be my fault. But so I'll do those kinds of things. And I'll see my friends. I have friends from every level of society in Haiti. And that's what I meant. I don't think it's going to be a relationship that ever ends, at least not on my part.
But taking less, huh, and giving more?
Taking less and giving more. I don't think it would be possible for me to have taken more from Haiti. I have taken my whole career from Haiti. I've made money off the backs of earthquake victims, if you look at it that way, by writing about it. You know, at least an eighth of my income since the earthquake has probably come from Haiti. So I see myself as a leech. but I'm also trying to get the truth out. I keep telling myself, you're not just, a bloodsucker. You're also trying to do good, and I hope that's true. I try to convince myself.
Well, this book is part of that. Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti by Amy Wilentz. I appreciate you talking to us.
Thanks a lot.
This is Weekday. Amy Wilentz is reading at Town Hall tonight. You can find out more at our website or at our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. Stay with us.
Forty-four degrees in Seattle, cloudy with rain moving in today, should turn to showers this afternoon, and it probably won't get any warmer than it is right now.
Support for KUOW comes from University Volkswagen Audi, committed to providing customer care through the exclusive Passport.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.